This month's Sinister Podcast is sponsored by Commonwealth Classics. Commonwealth Classics is a direct importer of classic vehicles from Europe and South America and has a rotating collection of rare and unique Land Rovers. Their showroom is located in Virginia, just 45 minutes west of Washington, D.C. Visit www.cwclassics.com to view their inventory of classic vehicles and follow them on Instagram at Commonwealth_Classics. Thank you, Commonwealth Classics, for your continued support of the podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners.
Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, podcast number 103 for October 2021. Center Steer is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. I'm your host, John Kostich. Joining me via Zoom is Morgan and Harold. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
It's good to be back.
Dixon's supposed to be here. It's Rover night for him, and apparently he's probably forgot to join us today.
Maybe the Sky Creeper is on the no-fly list or something.
Yes, we were trying to set this up, and he's like, "Oh, I have a stop time." We're like, "Okay, we'll start at this time," and here we are, and he's not here, but that's fine. Hopefully next time, Dixon. If you are new to the podcast, welcome. We talk about Land Rovers, new, old, things they are capable of, and the people who own and drive them. And if you're a returning listener, welcome back. Thank you for listening. An extra special thanks to our latest Patreon supporters, Bob, Jeff, and Kristen. We appreciate your support. You can visit our website to see how you can support the podcast. You can join Bob, Jeff, and Kristen as a Patreon supporter. You can buy a t-shirt or a sticker, and you can also buy us a tee. And that's just like Patreon, but you get to choose the amount when you do buy us a tee or buy me a tee. Or I think we should change it to buy us brown water.
Well, for Bob. Bob needs a special button, brown water.
We were finally able to make contact with Australia. We talked with Justin Burton. Justin is kind of, I guess, the organizer of Oxford in Australia. And Justin talked with us about plans for Oxford in Australia, his Land Rover connections, and his very interesting collection of Land Rovers. This is your monthly reminder that in 2023 is Land Rover's 75th anniversary. We are inviting all Land Rover owners to the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix in July of 2023, specially series and Defender owners. You now have 20 months to get your Rover ready. And stay tuned after we talk with Justin. I'll give you a review, so to speak, of MAR 2021. It's the last one at Wheatland Farm, and we'll talk about the plans for MAR of 2022. Now for the news. First up is sales. JLR worldwide sales fell 18.4% between July and September. It sold 92,710 cars, almost 21,000 cars fewer than the same three-month period last year. Jaguar sales were down almost 30% to 19,248 vehicles. Land Rover fell almost 15% to 73,462 vehicles. UK sales were down 47.6%.
Dang.
Yeah, sales were were lower year on year in most regions, including North America. North America was down 15.6%, China down 6.3%, Europe was down 17%.
Those are sales numbers, right? So that's not like something that's the result of the chip shortage or anything, right?
I think that was the number of produced vehicles. Yes,
those were sales. Okay. Those were vehicles sold.
Okay. So I was just curious, is that affected by pre-orders? Can you order them that even though we can't produce them, we'll take your money and take your order, or how's that all work?
I'm not sure how their pre-order works. I don't know if you have to put a down payment down or not. That's a good question. Don't know.
Yeah, I don't recall whether they have a down payment, but from what I read, this definitely does come from the chip shortage, and that they actually have like 125,000 vehicles, at least on the Land Rover side, on order.
Correct. Yeah, that's what they call that on the books, orders on the books, 125,000. Okay. That's probably mostly new Defenders too.
Right.
Well, but that would also, if it's factoring in the chip shortage, that would explain why the new Defender was still so much higher than all the other stuff, because that's the one they're still making.
Right. And it doesn't say it here, and I've not heard it, but I suspect they're prioritizing building the Defender too with the chips that they do have.
Yeah, build the one that uses the most of them when you don't have any.
It's also the hot model. Yeah, all models models were lower, with the exception of the new Defender, as in individual sales. 16,725 vehicles sold were up 70% year on year for the new Defender. It was the best selling model of the quarter. Shocker. And to your point, Harold, the company expects semiconductor shortages to gradually ease over in the next 12 months. Although I think that's just a they're hoping. I don't know that they actually know that.
Yeah, I mean, you can say stuff like that. I don't know if it's real.
Reading about some other makes that have cut back on production, but the one that hasn't is Toyota. I suspect Toyota was prepared for this, and since they're very large, they probably have a good supply of chips or good contracts with their makers.
Maybe that's why everybody's short on them, because Toyota's been hoarding.
Very possible. And speaking of the chip shortage, they have Jaguar Land Rover paused Howwood car production for a week. This was, I think, last week, based on when we're recording. They were forced to shut down car production at the plant because of a global shortage of computer chips. Assembly line workers returned to the factory in Merseyside a week after producing no vehicles. The plant makes the Disco Sport and the Evoque models, although it has struggled with supply issues throughout the year. This is from Jalopnik, and this is a... Actually, I was hoping Dixon would join us because he wanted us to add the story in. And the title is Three Funny Things Are Happening at JLR at the Same Time. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's a short piece, but there's a lot to it. It kind of boils down to Jaguar has their I-Pace, which is a competitor to Tesla. And it's an upscale competitor to Tesla. But it's not selling well. And because it's not selling well, then JLR is going into a pool with other companies to get emission credits in Europe so they do not get fined for not meeting emission conditions and regulations. And the company that they're getting these credits from is Tesla. Yeah, it's just this weirdness of, you know, I guess a car they expected that they was going to sell well and going to do well, and it was an all-electric, the I-Pace was all-electric in competing with Tesla, not selling well, but now they're going to their competitor to get these emission credits.
So they're buying emissions credits from their competitor so that they can in turn produce gas-guzzling Range Rovers. Okay.
Exactly.
Well, not get fined. How about that, Harold? They're still, right, they can produce them, right? But yeah.
Well, yeah, but it's the cap and trade thing to meet the yes, numbers.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they did pay a fine last year. Yeah. They're just trying to prevent that. But yeah, it is funny that they're especially through the chip shortage, focusing on like the Defender and the Range Rovers, their high end market vehicles, which are obviously the gas guzzlers. Yeah, that's just silly to trade credits when doing that.
Somewhat in their defense, I think they seem to have a plan to have better emission producing vehicles. Is that a right phrase? And they had a plan for that. And then they had their financial difficulty. And then as they're trying to come out of that, then and COVID strikes, and they had, which pushed them back further. So I don't think it's completely that they weren't thinking about this or preparing for it. I think they did seem like they had a plan to do it. And then extraordinary things happen, which has caused them now to, you know, talk to their competitor about these credits.
It's been a perfect storm in a lot of industries along these lines.
Yep. And even with the sales at Jaguar down, what was it, 40%? The I-Pace was actually up. But, you know, still, they're probably having trouble getting chips for the all-electric vehicle, which uses even more chips. And so focusing on the high-ticket items.
And probably batteries, too. They don't produce their own batteries, right? They get them from some other manufacturer, I suspect. So there may be an issue there also. I mean, that's, you know, Ford is investing heavily into battery production, and other major car companies are moving into battery production, too.
Yeah,
I don't think JLR is ever going to have the size to justify a battery manufacturing facility. I think they're going to be buying them forever.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
All right. Land Rover settles with Volkswagen over two similar off-road tech lawsuit. JLR has settled patent fights it lodged against Volkswagen and its brands over a feature used in luxury sport utility vehicles that simplifies off-road driving for affluent but inexperienced drivers. The agreements resolve litigation in Germany and the U.S., but other terms of the deals weren't disclosed with filings in courts and here in the U.S. with the International Trade Commission. The settlement came about a week before JLR, which is owned by Tata, was to begin a trial in which it was seeking to block imports of the into the U.S. of Volkswagen's Porsche, Lamborghini, Audi, and Volkswagen SUVs that Land Rover claimed used its patented terrain response technology without permission. Lawsuit has gone away, but there's no terms disclosed. What will Volkswagen do? Are they going to name it something else? Or I guess we may find out eventually.
I thought the real issue was that they were using a knob to control it. And that somehow
switched to push button or something.
Yeah. Actually, you're right. It is I didn't highlight this, but yeah, the next article paragraph says the dispute was over an invention in which a simple turn of a knob instructs the vehicle systems to adapt to different terrains.
So now you use a push button or a lever or something.
As long as it's not a knob.
Right.
Next up, Jaguar makes tools in-house after £1.7 million investment. JLR has started to make its own press tools in-house for the first time, following a £1.7 million investment at its Howe Wood plant on Merseyside. The tools are the first stage in the manufacture of car body panels during new vehicle production. The parts had previously been made in Asia. Press parts manager Niall Ford said, "We bring in large coils of steel and then we unwind them and cut them in individual pieces and then we stamp them into the sides of our cars and the parts and go on to the underside." So it's quite a critical part of the business. JLR makes the Evoque and the Discovery Sport at Hellwood, as we mentioned earlier. Kind of surprised that was the first time they're doing that. I guess they hadn't done that previously. Well,
I guess if it's cheaper to outsource, you do that. But now with all that supply chain stuff coming out of Asia, maybe they just find it's just a lot less hassle to make them in-house.
Well, I wonder what they did back in the early days. Was that, did maybe the Rover car company make them and they were other parts of the UK maybe?
No, there was a company I thought that made stuff ended up being absorbed into British Leyland. I forget the name, but there was a big company that was making all the press steel. So I think it was just easier to outsource.
Right. Back then, you know, having a machine shop a press shop was just common still at that time. Whereas now it really, that trade is not in the UK anymore.
Well, and of course the I don't know about the Rover cars, the Land Rover, you didn't need much tooling to make those. You could just bang them over a rock and there you go. That'll fit.
Isn't that how they put the doors on? Right. They put a piece of metal up and then they just kind of tapped and drilled in. Right.
Pretty much.
And I think the wings too, they just put there and then some guy put his arm down, rolled it over.
Well, I do know from experience that you cannot pull the tub skin off of one truck and put it on the other without moving all the holes.
Yes.
Because all the spot welds are just arbitrary.
Wherever they felt like it that day.
Yeah. This looks like a spot. Ka-chunk. Here looks good. Ka-chunk.
How could that be inefficient?
No, not at all.
Who would do that for 60 some years and make it that way? I don't understand. Why would you do that?
67.
Breaking news on the podcast. The 2022 Range Rover has been announced. Was actually announced yesterday, so it's not too breaking, but for us it's breaking enough. In the 9 years since the introduction of the current Range Rover, the luxury SUV market has undergone a transformational renaissance. What was once the only choice in the segment has had to fend off attacks from Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Bentley, Lamborghini, and Rolls-Royce. For 2022, the Range Rover is fighting back, armed with new technology popularized by its rivals, tweaked styling, and a new ultra-luxury interior. The new Range Rover is coming back for the throne. That starts with the incorporation of Dynamic Response Pro, Land Rover's branded name for 48-volt active anti-roll bar. Similar systems have proven transformative in SUVs like the Bentley Bentayga, the Lamborghini. The secret ingredient that allows big 5,000-pound SUVs to corner as flat as sports car sedans without sacrificing ride quality.
So it sounds like Range Rover is getting back at Volkswagen for having their knob appropriated by appropriating their suspension technology.
Maybe that's the undisclosed terms of the deal.
You can have your knob, we get your suspension.
First-year customers will be able to choose between the silky turbocharged Ingenium inline 6, 395 horsepower, or the beefier 4.4-liter twin turbocharged V8, 523 horsepower. The 4.4-liter V8 is sourced from BMW, which is used in cars like the M55i and the X7, which as real geeky Land Rover people will know that the X series of BMW comes from Range Rover, because that's when BMW bought Land Rover, they got it so they could get Range Rover information for making their X Series. The quickest version of the V8 should hit 60 in 4.4 seconds. everybody drink when I laugh at how fast a Land Rover goes in 60 seconds.
1 second per liter. That's not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all.
Those more interested in efficiency will be glad to hear that a plug-in hybrid with 62 miles of all-electric range will be added for the 2023 model, and a fully electric Range Rover set to debut in 2024. And an article after this talks a little more about that. Inside, the third row seats are also available, a first for the full-size Range Rover. So a third row of seats. The side profile now draws the eye to the abrupt and angular rear end, which has been stretched vertically and horizontally by a new rear lighting element in the shape of an elongated horseshoe. The design gives the Range Rover far more visual heft to differentiate it from its more streamlined Sport and Velar siblings. But the end result is no less sensational than the last model.
I think we should clarify those taillights are actually not shaped like a horseshoe, but a polo pony shoe.
Nicely done, Harold.
Because, you know, let's get our context correct here.
So we've talked on the podcast a lot about what is happening with the Discovery, you know, the full-size proper Discovery. And I think seeing, as I'm going to tell you in just a moment, what the price is of the new full-size Range Rover, I think we are going to understand what's happening with Discovery. So prices start for the full-size new Range Rover, $105,350 American, including destination charges, with the long wheelbase 7-seat version kicking off at $111,000. Don't think it ends there. In an effort to stay on the top, Land Rover has continuously added to its list of ultra luxury options a long wheel-based first edition version with available lounge style rear seats and a V8 powertrain will set you back $163,850. Looks like deliveries are scheduled for spring of 2022. And they have a picture of the rear lounge seat. It's like a plane in there. It's really nice.
So if you have a spare 160 grand laying around, you can either go down to your dealer and plunk down for the new full fat Range Rover, or you can head on over to Bring a Trailer and buy yourself an old 110.
Yes. Yes. Which will we have more fun with?
Well, you know which way I'd go.
Oh, absolutely. So a little bit more on the electric. This is from a different article, CNET. They say a full electric version of the Range Rover is on the way. It's supposed to debut in 2024. Expect at least one electric motor at each axle with a range of around 300 miles and a power output of at least 600 horsepower. And this is in the meantime here, the Range Rover will gain plug-in hybrid model for the 2023 model year in place of the old PHEV 4-cylinder engine. The new one uses JLR's Ingenium turbocharged 3-liter inline six paired with a 38.2 kilowatt hour battery pack and an electric motor integrated in the transmission. In total, the PHEV puts out 434 horsepower and Land Rover claims an EV range of 62 miles, more than three times that of the outgoing model. So that's the upcoming full-size Range Rover all-electric, which will probably start at over $100,000, just because that's what the price is now for that.
Well, it's got to go for more than the gasoline version, which the gasoline version starts at 106, so the electric's got to be north of 110, even as a base model electric.
Right. You know, the new design is certainly a little more aerodynamic than the outgoing design. Not drastically, but I wonder how much that has to play with the increased all-electric range.
Oh, because it looks more sleek and the sides are completely smooth because they're using the Velar door handles.
Right. Yeah, because that actually is an incredibly large factor in range.
Well, drag reduction affects fuel mileage or electron mileage the same way. So, you know, energy is energy. It has to come from somewhere to propel the vehicle. Yep. So the less drag you have, the less energy you use, and the less energy you pull out of your battery, the longer you can do it.
Precisely.
Interesting on the design. The front still, to me, looks like a standard traditional Range Rover, but the side looks a lot like the Velar, very smooth, and it's not straight, but it has that kind of roundedness to it, and then it goes almost like a torpedo in the back, traditional torpedo kind of tapers to the back. So I'm wondering, what's the new Velar going to be like? How are they going to differentiate it from the full size? But they'll probably just taper the rear hatch down as they do currently.
It'll just be a scale model of it.
Right.
Maybe with like a 2-inch roof chop, less greenhouse in the Velar.
And the new one, I think it's the biggest ever Range Rover. This thing looks massive. I don't know if it's the how it's designed, that it looks larger. There's nothing to break up the side, but it certainly looks very large.
I wonder if it is larger.
I thought I read that it was the largest, longest Range Rover.
It certainly wouldn't make sense that they've, you know, with the long wheelbase now, managed to fit in a third row. You know, 7 passengers.
None of us have asked the question, how does it do off-road? Who's the first to take their 100,000-plus vehicle off-road?
My prediction is it will be a resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Those guys just, they throw money down on that stuff, and then they beat the crap out of it in the woods. They don't care.
All right, well, move on to the new Discovery. I think, as we've talked about the new Range Rover, and I think we're starting to see now where things are going to fit and what's happened with the what we previously thought was a lost model, the Discovery. And they're coming out in 2023. They've revealed the Discovery Metropolitan Edition. So sitting at the top of the Discovery lineup, the new Metropolitan Edition provides a host of exterior upgrades and standard features, including a powerful 355 horsepower, 3-liter Ingenium 6-cylinder powertrain featuring a 48-volt mild hybrid technology. And this is from Finbar McFall, the Land Rover brand director. He says, the introduction of the Metropolitan Edition brings a new level of premium appeal to the Land Rover Discovery. The 2023 Land Rover Discovery is priced, this is the non-Metropolitan Edition, is priced at $56,000 in the U.S. The Metropolitan Edition is available to order at $75,300 U.S.
So the Disco is reestablishing itself as the poor man's full-size Range Rover.
Yes. Especially now that the Range Rover's gone to, I guess, ultra luxury. Is that beyond premium now? It sounds like it's just Disco's moved into the premium category.
Well, the full fat Range Rover has, but there's still plenty of other stuff that carries the Range Rover name that is not. I mean, you can spend less on a Range Rover than you can on a Disco if you want to get one of the small ones.
Right.
Yeah.
But for full size,
right. Part of the family. If you're comparing full size to full size, then yeah, I mean, the Disco is like half the cost of the full fat.
So I guess it took the new Range Rover to figure out and finally reveal what's happened to all three families, the Range Rover family, the Discovery family, and the Defender family.
Don't want to spend six figures? Well, here, let's take a look at a Disco.
And it's priced at what full-size Range Rover used to be.
Yep.
Defender news, Land Rover Defender Hybrid confirmed for U.S. CarBuzz has discovered that the 2022 Land Rover Defender PHEV was uploaded to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's website, which means it has been registered in the U.S. The Defender PHEV is equipped with the same turbocharged 4-pot as used in the P300 models. It gets a P400E badge, which is the first clue as to how potent this plug-in can be. The gas engine works alongside a 141 horsepower electric motor, which results in a combined power output of 398 horsepower, 470 pound-feet of torque. It gets the Defender to 60 miles an hour in. Anybody want to guess how quick a new Defender?
5.2.
Morgan?
I'm going to say 5.5.
Right around it. 5.4 seconds. New Defender, 0 to 60, 5.4 seconds, the PHEV model. And this makes it the quickest Defender not equipped with a supercharged V8. Land Rover claims it's capable of doing 71 miles per gallon E in all electric mode. It can cover 27 miles. And using DC rapid charging, it will charge 80% in 30 minutes. And from your standard wall box, it would take about 2 hours to get to 80%. The PHEV uses the same permanent four-wheel drive system and terrain response trickery as any other model, so it will keep on working even if you run the battery down. So that is your new coming Defender Hybrid.
I certainly think that's going to be a fun model off-road, because 27 miles is a decent range in pure electric, which is great off-road to be completely silent, just rolling along.
Yeah, except all the people standing on the side of the trail might not hear you coming at them.
That's right.
True.
Well, unless you hit something, you know, a tree, a rock.
I wonder how much that range gets reduced while you're winching.
Ooh, good point.
So is JLR planning to do a charging network?
I've not heard anything about that.
Or is it strictly going to be an at-home thing?
Probably be an at-home thing. There is discussion here in the U.S. I've seen some rumblings, rumors, whatever word you want to use, of there being a common charging type. Tesla, I know they've set up their own charging network, but they use a proprietary plug. There's right. discussions of using a standard uniform plug across the country. Ford, I believe, has talked about coming out with their own network. I think even General Motors has talked about coming out with their own network. I don't know if they're going to be sharing any of the plug-in types, you know, where it is understood, you know, that having a common plug would be a boon to the industry versus having proprietary plugs for different vehicles and different charging capabilities.
I wonder if that could be accomplished with just like an adapter, like when you travel to Europe, you need the little thing to put between right. your plug and the wall.
And you can take that big one when you go to the UK, they've got the two prongs that go the wrong way.
Yeah.
You have your universal adapter as you drive around the world.
Interesting. Yeah. I just read an article and I probably should have sent it over to you, but Porsche/Audi, and I'm not sure if Volkswagen is part of this or not, but they just evaluated their global charging network. They have determined that their network is now delivering 1.21 gigawatts.
Sweet.
Just in time for Back to the Future Day.
Excellent. You know, with Tesla having their standard, I wouldn't be surprised if smaller companies like Land Rover might join with, say, Tesla to use their network or maybe use their proprietary plug.
That pay some sort customers. Of licensing fee to access their...
Right. And
that's an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, I could see that happening. Because also Tesla, while they are competitors, they've also have given away, and even though they have patents on certain things for electric vehicles, they've allowed other people to use those patents and not held them. So it's possible they may see that as beneficial to the industry in general.
I would think that licensing access to their charging network is no different than like BMW selling engines to everybody.
All right. Cars.com has a short article here. The 2021 Land Rover Defender, 6 pros and 5 cons. I thought it was worth looking at these, especially the cons, because we usually just hear about the good things. But the good things are it gets going. As we know, it's pretty quick. The 4-door Defender 3-liter V6 gets a respectable 395 horsepower. Quick shifting. The Defender's 8-speed automatic transmission downshifts eagerly at highway speeds. It's surprisingly agile. The tall front seating position affords a commanding forward view, ensuring the person behind the wheel can plan ahead. A lot to stow for. Clever, convenient stuff stashing spaces. Say that 3 times. Include a cabin-spanning recessed dashboard face. We know it's an ode to the series trucks. Large door pockets and an open storage area where the center console meets the dash. That's like open behind the under the dash behind the center console. And the final one here is intuitive technology. Which I think this is a good thing, because it's a turnaround for a problem that JLR had in their entertainment system. The Defender's single 10-inch dash-mounted touchscreen with physical climate controls positioned just below make it easy to use. And Land Rover's Pivi Pro multimedia system boasts intuitive, vividly renders menus and navigation. So those are your pros on it, which is the first time I think we've not heard a bad thing about their entertainment system. So that's a good thing that the Pivi Pro seems to be an improvement.
Or at least it's the first time we've seen anything related to their infotainment being listed in a pro column.
In a positive light. Yes. Yeah.
Whether or not it also appears in the con is yet to be seen.
And the 5 things they don't like. Hindsight, not exactly 2020, the broad B pillars and full-size spare tire mounted on the swing gate conspire to compromise over the shoulder and rear visibility, respectively. In other words, spring for that available rear view camera mirror that displays a live feed of what's coming up behind you that help eliminate at least the blind spot.
No worse than a soft top with no windows in the side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and honestly, most vehicles at this point have horrendous rearward views.
They do.
Hence the requirement over here for rear view cameras.
I've put a ClearSight backup camera in my Defender, and it's fantastic. It makes a world of difference. You can put stuff in the back of the vehicle and you can still see out what's happening behind you. Unless, of course, it's nighttime, in which case headlights, you know, one giant blob of white light behind you. Yeah, just drive forward.
Yeah, most people are challenged enough just to be watching ahead of them.
Yes, that's true. Another negative here. First, I've heard this. This is backseat put down. The 2-row Defender 110's 40-20-40 split backseat 8 also uses an older folding design that's surprising to see in an all-new vehicle. Rather than simply folding the backrest to extend the cargo floor, you must first flip the seat cushion forward to get a flat 4. So you fold the seat cushion forward, then I guess the backrest comes down. So it takes a lot of effort to restore the heavy setbacks, seatbacks to their upright position also. Whereas I think the Disco is completely flat, right? I mean, they've had the LR3, the LR4, now the D5, they're all completely flat in the back.
I haven't really seen those, you know, flip the seat base up and then fold the back down since the like Toyota 4Runners, like the 90s and early 2000s ones. That's definitely an old design.
But if they have the newer design, because they're doing it in the other models, interesting that they couldn't carry over to.
That's the way my Jetta works. Yours is the same way, and that's a 13, so that's a little newer, but still, it works for some stuff, maybe not so much for others.
Next is comfort compromise from the jump, uncomfortable seating position. This is the center jump, the jump seat. When I say from jump, I mean the center jump seat is uncomfortable and may make a middle passenger want to jump out of the jump seat.
Well, I mean, come on. Some things never change. I mean, it's a middle seat. What are you expecting?
Yeah, exactly.
At least you're not constantly getting elbowed every time the driver shifts.
Well, there you go. Right. Or have to move your legs and all that. Yeah.
Well, that takes some of the sport out of it.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Next, fewer doors, less cargo space in the two-door Defender. That's the D90. Cargo space behind the back seat is stingy and the seat doesn't fold flat with a cargo floor. Pack light. And having seen one, which I'll tell you about later in the program, I actually drove the Defender 90 that Jeff Aronson had borrowed. Yeah, there's very little room in the back. You might be able to put a golf bag sideways, fit in there. That's about it. Not a lot of room.
But it's a 90. You don't buy them for the cavernous space.
Exactly right. You are correct. And finally, a swing and a miss. Defender's rear swing gate is fine when you're off-roading in wide open spaces, but it can make things tricky when you're parallel parking in the city and trying to get your groceries up to your apartment before your chunky monkey melts. I think they didn't change the door either for North America, so it opens against the side of the road that you're typically on, like my Defender does.
Exactly. Yeah, they did not change that. And, you know, I have to say that actually, it's probably going to be less of a problem in the US because we generally tend to design for a lot more cars, even in our cities. And so a lot less of parking is parallel parking, but still it would be a pain in the city.
And the parallel parking spaces are laid out for longer vehicles than the 90s. So
yeah, but what if you have a 110 and you're trying to get something out of the back?
Well, you know what? Put your important stuff in the back seat. Where it belongs.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's where you keep your ice cream. You put your ice cream right in the side door. You can get it quickly and go.
Harold, you're missing something here. That's what that pannier is for on the side.
The pollen sack?
Yes. You know, that way you just put you can put
your ice. I don't think it's thick enough to get a pint in there. Maybe you can stand up an ice cream cone.
See, you're missing something. That could be the opportunity there to keep it as a little cooler, put some ice in there.
It would have to be a thicker case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it's not insulated.
But yeah, that could be like a new pack that they have, the ice cream run pack, some sort of electrically cooled outer thing on the side that you put your Ben and Jerry's into.
Well, couldn't you route a tube from the air conditioned system into there? And then like they do with the glove boxes to cool those.
You could, or just one of those thermoelectric cooler things.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Those aftermarket for someone to get onto. All right, let's move on to Enos unveils fuel cell SUV prototype, announces hydrogen production plans. Enos announced a $2.3 billion investment in what the British chemical company calls green hydrogen production, while also unveiling prototype fuel cell version of its planned Grenadier SUV. The investment will fund hydrogen plants in Norway, Germany, Belgium, and the UK to be used to produce hydrogen through electrolysis. The company already operates some electrolysis plants, though it's through a subsidiary, and claims to be the largest operator of such plants in Europe. The fuel cell Grenadier prototype uses Hyundai powertrain technology. The two companies signed a memorandum of understanding in 2020. To collaborate on fuel cell projects. While Enos has only shown the single prototype so far, a production version is now expected around 2024. The Grenadier is scheduled to launch in the United States in 2023. To keep things simple, Enos plans one powertrain, a 3-liter turbocharged inline six from BMW. It will be coupled to an 8-speed automatic transmission, 4-wheel drive system with a 2-speed transfer case. A diesel will be offered in other markets. Enos has indicated U.S. pricing will fall somewhere between mainstream off-roaders like the Bronco and the Wagoneer and the more luxurious Mercedes G-Class.
It's a pretty big window.
So how are they producing the power for those electrolysis plants? So it takes a lot of electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen.
Well, I guess that's why they invested $2.3 billion.
I'm just thinking that's kind of the hang up in doing the whole hydrogen thing is you've got to make the hydrogen. And if you're trying to make hydrogen to save the environment, you're killing the environment, making the hydrogen with which to save the environment.
Yeah, since they said one of the plants was Norway, right? Maybe they're doing hydro on the fjords.
Yeah, I just don't know if you can make enough to you know, it'd be a small production, I guess.
You just wanted to say hydro in the fjords.
It's true.
Hydro in the fjords. A Land Rover Defender with aircraft-inspired camper is out of this world. The Duckworth Air Rover, that's A-E-R-O-V-E-R, is a new overlander from England that combines the frame and front of an old Land Rover Defender, we'd say heritage, with a body taking inspiration from a 1930s aero-style trailer. Think of the classic Airstream. It's a handsome machine, and Duckworth is now looking for a customer who wants to commission a personalized interior for this first build. Duckworth starts with a new Defender 130 galvanized chassis and fits a self-leveling air suspension. The company uses a TD5 2.5-liter 5-cylinder turbo diesel, redundancy there, with modifications like new fuel injectors and a remapped engine management system. Tweaks to the clutch make shifting easier, and as an alternative, a customer can specify a BMW X5 engine and gearbox. Duckworth makes the rear living area from an aluminum frame with aluminum panels riveted to it. The company has to craft each piece by hand. Composite materials act as reinforcements for vulnerable areas.
What's the projected price on that?
There is
so if
no
you have to ask,
listed price, sir.
You can't afford.
I suspect might be less than a new Range Rover, though. That's my suspect.
I don't know.
Suspect.
Considering that back half's made by hand, and they're building you a 130 on top of that, which isn't exactly cheap.
If you're using a TD5, would that doesn't meet the 25-year rule here in the U.S., right? So you couldn't import this one.
No, you could not.
So therefore, correct, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So no American buyers need apply.
Well, but on the other hand, they said that they could, for money, make you one with a BMW, which means for money, if you had the money and you wanted it in this country, you could probably convince them to put in an engine that is legal.
So if you're interested in a cool-looking Defender-type camper, Duckworth is waiting to hear from you.
Please give us some money. We'd like to build one.
And let them know that the podcast sent you, and we'd like to ride in it, maybe drive it if we get the opportunity. And finally, in the news, this is a SAS spec Land Rover gunship. It is a target for enthusiasts at auction. The one-off Series 3 109 is fitted with dummy machine guns that have been restored by vintage Land Rover specialist John Brown 4x4. It's available at Sotheby's auction. The auction is completed. I'll tell you about that in a moment. The left-hand drive machine was built by Land Rover at its Birmingham plant in 1984 and is thought to have been used by the German armed forces. Two military enthusiasts in York bought the vehicle in 2010, carried out a replication to SAS specifications. Both machine guns, a 30 and a 50 cal, are dummy weapons professionally made by Crossfire, and the Landy is completely road legal to drive. So it looks like a Pink Panther, but kind of like a modernized version of the Pink Panther, but it's not in pink. It's green and sand.
So just to be clear, this is a civilian vehicle. It's a tribute. It's not an ex-military.
No, I think it's ex-military German, though.
Oh, okay. So it isn't. Yeah. Okay. But it was built not in this configuration for the military. It was a couple of civilians that got themselves an old ex-military series truck and said, let's do...
Yes, correct.
Let's do the Pink Panther without the pink paint.
Right. That's my impression of that, yeah.
I think it's to the SAS spec, so
right.
They probably had some in production.
Well, the SAS Rover was usually better known as the Pink Panther because they used so many of them in the desert, in the sand, but if they were using them somewhere else, they would be in a color that wasn't pink.
Yeah.
it's still functionally pretty much the same truck.
True.
We'll have links in the show notes, of course, with there's a bunch of pictures you can look at. It doesn't have the tire in the front, in front of the grill, as you would expect.
Blocking the airflow.
Blocking the airflow, yes.
Which I never thought made sense in the hot desert. But.
Right. So it did sell at auction, and it went for 11,000 pounds sold.
That's actually not bad.
No, that was pretty good. There's more detail here on the Sotheby's site. It's an 84 Series 3 109. They call it military style. Based on long wheelbase version of the Series 3, fitted with a 2.25 liter inline four petrol four-speed manual gearbox, believed to have been delivered new to military forces overseas, registered in the UK, converted to quote-unquote SAS specification featuring dummy machine gun, the dummy guns we talked about, spare wheels, jerry cans, special software equipment are mounted to the body. Light recommissioning work in 2020 by Land Rover specialist John Brown 4x4 included fan belt replacement, brake service, new front shock absorbers, odometer just over 65,000 kilometers at time of cataloging.
You know, that would be legal to import to the U.S. under the 25-year rule.
Oh, because it's an 84.
It's an 84, right. And it's got the original 2.25. It's not been updated, so it's got the original engine, so it is eligible for the 25-year exemption. I just wonder what customs would think of all the fake guns all over it.
Could you have them sent separately?
Yeah, I would assume. I mean, yeah, anything. Parts is parts. But
oh, honestly, if they probably care less about that than whether it's a 25-year mark Land Rover.
Probably. And I suspect you could probably get some sort of certificate along with it saying that the guns are all fake.
If you, there was your chance if you were interested in a SAS spec owed to military vehicle Land Rover. Someone has purchased it. You need to reach out to Sotheby's. So that is the news for October 2021. And now on this Understeer podcast, it's time for Oxford in Australia. Joining us from Queensland is Justin Burton. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Hi, and hi, everybody.
So Queensland on Australia, Queensland is a state, right? Or
Queensland is a big state, yes.
And that's where Sydney is, right?
Oh, Sydney's about 960 kilometers away.
Wow. So that's in New South Wales, right?
That's in New South Wales, yes. That's over the border. In fact, we've got our borders about 30 minutes from where I live, and we can go over the border, but we're not allowed to come back really at the moment because of COVID.
Really?
Which is...
Sorry, in fact, laughing.
In fact, so, you know, we shouldn't really talk about COVID too much, but it's bizarre. But on the 1st of November, you can actually fly from Sydney to London Heathrow, but you can't fly from Brisbane to Sydney.
Okay. Well, you know, odd COVID stuff here in North America. Yeah. You could have flown from Canada to the U.S., but you couldn't cross the border in a vehicle.
Bizarre, isn't it?
It was very bizarre.
Yeah, so Dixon can fly in and play with Land Rovers, but he can't drive it home.
That's right.
No. How did Oxford get to Australia? And tell us a little bit about that story. And also, what's the plans for Oxford in Australia?
Well, I was talking to a good friend of mine, Mike Bishop, who you've obviously been on your show, from Land Rover Classic. And it just came up in conversation. We were actually talking about the 75th anniversary event down at Cooma, which hopefully will go ahead. And I was really just trying to judge with Mike at the time, you know, what involvement Land Rover would have in the 75th. But he was basically, it's far too in the future for them to even make a decision. And then we just got on to Oxford and basically talked about Adam, who obviously owns Oxford, being a Yorkshireman as well, like myself. And I just basically touched base with Rod Corbin, who I think you've had on the show.
Correct.
Yep. I had a chat with Rod and we actually flew over, I think we flew over in May, not to see Oxford. I think Oxford was up in storage in one of the other island, but we went to Rod's house for dinner. Met his lovely wife, which was really nice. Talked about Land Rovers. I think that was in Wanaka. And yeah, and we basically, it went from there, really. We decided it would be a good thing for us to do. I mean, you know, we do have a business. We sell Land Rover spares and accessories, but we are actually enthusiasts and we're very passionate about the brand. Good. Whereas a lot of companies, you know, just sell the parts and they're there to make the money. Whereas we are very enthusiastic. So I thought it was a good thing to get Oxford here and basically, you know, get the Land Rover community on board. The only stumbling block, and I'll be honest with you with this one, is that we had zero input from Land Rover Australia, not bothered one little bit, which was a shame. And in fact, Mike told me that when I spoke to Mike. And it's a shame because I think in America and certainly in New Zealand, Land Rover in those countries have really supported Oxford on its journey.
More so in New Zealand, definitely.
Yeah. But so for here, it's obviously a logistical, not a nightmare, but to get Oxford from one state to another is quite a big undertaking, and it's costly, as in it could be anything up to, you know, $1,500 to transport Oxford each way every time it goes somewhere. So for us, we are looking at how we can kind of we can't financially support that, but Oxford, we've got people on board and we've got clubs on board. For one, the borders open, so hopefully he can start visiting other states like similar to what he did in New Zealand. Really, he came in July, which was amazing. He actually got here. It was a bit of a shock because he was going to go on a vessel direct to Australia, but had to go all the way to Japan on a Ro-Ro, and then all the way so sailed past us and then came back. But it was all good. Obviously he failed quarantine because we've got some of the strictest quarantine rules in the world, and even though Rod and his team did a fantastic job cleaning Oxford, I've never had a Land Rover ever that has passed inspection. Even my Camel Trophy, what came, which is a nut and bolt restoration, they still had to go and clean it. But anyway, Oxford came, and it was actually when he came on the transporter, started first time. And I must admit, when I first sat in that car, I was just like, wow. It was just like, wow. I'm in this little Land Rover. And yeah, we just drove it around the complex where work is. And I was just like, oh my God, it was just such an amazing feeling.
Gets to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. And I just, yeah, it's hard to explain, you know, and it's such a significant, I say to people who are not into Land Rovers, you know, that particular vehicle holds, you know, in history, motoring history, it's very significant, you know, being one of the two first vehicles ever to do an overland expedition. So it's not just, I don't think you just have to be into Land Rovers to appreciate what Oxford is and where he came from.
We've had to do the same here, explain what Oxford meant here in the US, and many people just don't get it, but you do your best.
I had Oxford at my house for a night, and I just tell my friends it's a lot like Elvis dropping by and crashing on your couch.
I walk into work every day and I see Oxford, and I'm like, he's still, you know, and it's been difficult we've had some quite severe lockdowns as well in Queensland, snap lockdowns where you can't do anything. So trying to plan events has been difficult. We were lucky though, once we got Oxford, we did an MOT or a roadworthy, as you might, I don't know what you call it over there, you know, inspection. To get the tickets, we put it, yeah, in a road inspection. And the first event we did was a great event. We had about 40 Land Rovers, and we went down to Surfers Paradise, which is a little bit like the Glitter Strip, I suppose, in Miami, big skyscrapers overlooking the ocean. And then we went out to the countryside, the hinterland, and went to a lovely vineyard for a dinner. So, and then we ended up at the car museum, which we got a car museum or a motor museum, which opened about a year ago. They're very supportive of classic cars, so we had a dinner there. So it was nice to get Oxford out on his first little adventure.
So this motoring museum opened up in the middle of COVID. What's its focus, and where is it located?
Literally about 10 minutes over that hill from where I am.
And for those listening at home, he's pointing ahead.
I'm looking at the video, but there's no video for everybody else, just audio. Yes, it's
so,
literally
so
about
turn it. Around and look behind you as you listen to this.
It's at the bottom of a place called Tambourine Mountain, and Tambourine Mountain is a rainforest in the hinterland, which is the countryside, which would you call it if you lived in England. I think it's been open a year and a little bit. It's a good because it's not just full of boring Australian Holdens and Fords, because obviously the diehard Australians love the Holdens and they love the Fords. So it's got a vast array of cars. It's not even got a DeLorean in there.
So, some of us non-Australians like the Holdens and the.
I can't stand them.
Well, I mean, but you're used to them. For us, they're unique. They're special. They're different.
Yeah, but I don't. There's a lot more European cars here now, which is, I mean, they don't make Holdens anymore in Australia or Fords. I don't think
they don't make Holdens anywhere anymore.
Yeah. No.
Actually, for a hot minute, they sent Holdens to America as Pontiac G8s.
They sent them to the UK, the Ute version. I think there was a HRV, a V8 or something. I don't think the Brits kind of warmed to them, to be honest with you.
Well, I don't think they could afford the fuel.
So what's the next event then coming up for Oxford?
Yeah, so we did the Gold Coast. We did an event with Land Rover at the Gold Coast. We worked very closely with our local dealer. That was a fantastic day. They really went out there. They had a band on. They had a coffee cart, you know, donuts, cakes and things. So people just came down and we had, I think it was probably the first time maybe in 40 or 50 years that every single car in the showroom was a manual.
Wow.
And I think, you know, you think about now and Land Rover's range, there's no manuals in the range anymore.
Nope.
And it was just, there was a 50, 55, there was Oxford, there was a Camel Trophy, there was a 73 Range Rover 3-door, some Defenders, Adventurer, Heritage, plus some E-Type Jaguar. So it was good. There was old Jags as well as Land Rover. And it was a really good morning. Lots of people came down and had the photographs taken, you know, that pause in Oxford with you.
That's a lot of oil slicks in the parking lot.
We had, we must have had maybe 15, 20 oil trays in the showroom because you know what showrooms are like, beautiful floors. But so that went down well. What have we done? And then, well, our next outing, we're going up to the Sunshine Coast. So that's further north. And we're going to be going and doing an event with the Sunshine Coast Land Rover Club probably next month in November. And then plans after will depend on the borders opening, whenever that may be. We wanted to do a big run down to the Northern Rivers, which I don't know whether you've ever done, Byron Bay. It's quite synonymous. Chris Hemsworth, actor, he lives there. Lots of famous people live in Byron, but it's a trendy place. But it's lovely down there. It's a lovely part of the coast. So we'll as soon as the borders open, we'll do a weekend run down there. And then we've got probably April or May, we've got Oxford's Outback Expedition plan. So we're going to take Oxford actually to proper Australia, which is the desert. And it's a 12, 14-day trip. I'm hopeful we could have probably up to 150 Land Rovers. So I've done a couple of trips myself over the years. It's quite slow going, but it's good because everywhere we go in other than one place has got a pub. So that's very important.
Yes, it is.
But it's not just about having fun with Land Rovers. It's also supporting the communities out there, which have been absolutely devastated by COVID, you know, very little tourism. So we'll inject some money back into those communities as well as having a great time with lots of Land Rovers.
Do you expect to drive Oxford around or is it going to be trailered and then maybe driven locally?
Well, it takes 2 days to get to the start of where we're going.
Right.
Yes. So we will we've got a big truck now. We've got a big car transport. So we'll take Oxford down on the car transport and we're actually going to start off in a place called Burke. And then we go through basically to Innaminka, Cameron Corner. There's a place called the Dig Tree, which is a very famous Burkes and Wills, who the explorers going back in the day. So there's a lot of history as well where we're going. And, you know, some of those places, there is literally just a pub in the town is a pub. And there's two people live in the town, but that's the pub. So,
well, if there's a pub, there's a town.
Yeah, but driving, I've done it in series vehicles before. It's not difficult. Probably the longest day will be like 300 kilometers. The shortest day might be about 120. It's no race. It's just
no.
And people will get a chance to drive Oxford a little bit and, you know, enjoy what Oxford's all about.
Do you intend to take Oxford to, you know, different club events or take it on? I assume there are good off-roading and trail rides, I assume, in Australia.
Well, we've spoken to a number of clubs again once the borders open, but we've got the
I understand. Sydney. Yeah, the whole COVID obviously is a big asterisk here.
It is, but we've already talked to a few groups. So there's a Sydney Land Rover Club. There's a club of the ACT. Melbourne. I think all those people want to come on board and do things. In fact, a great one, and I've never been to Tasmania. I had, there is a club down there, but this is a group of individuals, about 30 of them, and they're not part of the club for whatever reason, but they were like, we'll pay your expenses to come down, we'll put you on the ferry, we'll lend you a car if you need a car, come down to Tasmania. So that'll be a really good event. I've got a really good friend of mine, amazing video production. So we're actually making a video of everything that we're doing, and then we'll probably launch this video after the 75th. So that's all pretty exciting.
Are you going to have some location, say on Facebook or something, for folks to follow the journey?
Just set up a YouTube channel. So it'll be small snippets of video where we go. And then obviously after the 75th, which I think that'll be hopefully Oxford's last stand in Australia.
Also,
if it goes ahead.
You intend for Oxford to stay there through 2023?
Yeah, Adam's happy for Oxford to stay until, 2023? Yep. So that'll be April, May 2023.
Right, yeah, April would be is the official month.
Oxford ought to be well preserved in a dry place like Australia.
Well, yeah, I mean, we certainly don't have the salt on the road like they do in the UK.
Or here.
Or Canada.
That's not to say.
No. Canada has a little bit of road underneath the salt.
Mm. Okay, that's fair.
And in Quebec, they don't even put down salt. They just plow and they leave a couple inches of snow, and then you have to have snow tires anyway.
We do have snow in Australia, though. I'll just let you know, we do have lots of snow.
When? Yeah, in the stores, right? You have to buy it special order?
No, it's called the Snowy Mountains. In fact, it's where it all started for Land Rover, you know, the Snowy Mountain Hydro Scheme, where those first 200 Land Rovers actually came to Australia. But down there, there's some very, very good ski runs and ski resorts. Perisher, I think, Jindabyne, down there. But they get down to minus 10, minus 15 in winter.
Okay, yeah, that's legit.
I know I didn't know when I came here and I flew, and I remember the first time I ever came to Australia and I'm looking out of the plane, I actually thought how green it was. There was really no desert flying down the coast. And then I found out about the snow. I've not been down there, but yeah, very, very popular.
And that's the Snowy Mountain? That's in New South Wales?
No, the Snowy Mountains, and Coomer is where the 75th is, and that's where basically it's near the Snowy Mountains Hydro Scheme. So that's where, and I think that's the golden thing in Land Rovers over here. People are trying to find those early series ones.
Can you actually tell us about that story? Because we're not familiar with that. That's not part of the Land Rover lore here, at least in North America, is this scheme you were talking about, where Land Rovers, I guess, first were used in Australia?
Yeah, well, if you get a chance, Google the Snowy Mountains Hydroelectric Scheme, which is, I think, it was probably one of the biggest engineering project ever undertaken in Australia. So to build hydroelectric in the mountains, making dams and tunnels. But when that project started, that's some of the first 250 Land Rovers actually went to that particular project over its time. I think it was a 20, maybe 25 year.
1949 to 1974.
Yes, yeah, a long time. And a lot of migrants came as well. You know, it has a lot of workers into the country. So there's a lot of, it's not just all Australians. I think, a lot of those communities have a big mix of, you know, different people, mm-hmm. non-Indigenous, as they would say. But if you find a Series 1 from the Snowy Mountain scheme, yeah, they're fetching good money. Not that they found all of them, but.
Were they all Series 1s?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. The first lot were, yeah.
So the intent is to have Oxford at some event that's going to take place then at the Snowy Hydro?
It's really Land Rover's historical home down there, because that's where really all began. So that's why the event is held down at Coomer. And it usually every 10 years, but the 70th was such an amazing event. In fact, it was. I'll tell you a little bit of a funny thing here. So, Nick Rogers, who's one of the directors of Land Rover in the UK, and he's a fanatical fan. I think he's got a Series 1 himself. The organisers were trying to contact somebody high up in Land Rover, and it didn't go up the chain of command like, you know, it rarely does. And he found out 2 weeks before the 70th was about to happen. And he was told, and he was like, well, why didn't anybody, you know, tell me sooner? And he got on a plane, flew out to the 17th, and he had to sleep on somebody's floor because there was no hotels. There was nothing. And he was with Mike Bishop, actually, who were doing the compare, I think the word, isn't it, when you're on the stage and you're introducing et cetera and whatever. But he said it was such a good show that we should do a 75th, not an 80th, because a lot of the people are getting a bit older and might not be around.
Exactly, yes, yes.
10 years time. And even Phil Bashel from Dunsfolds, Phil was there with Rob Sprayson as well. Rob Sprayson's very well known, and in fact Rob does CKD in the UK. So they came over and they, again, they had such an amazing time. I mean, Phil even said he would like to get his amphib out to Australia. I don't know whether you know much about the amphib. I think it was trialed over here as an amphibious Land Rover, and then went back to the UK, and the Australians never purchased one. But he's fully restored, and he said, if I can bring that to the 75th, that, you know, so we were trying to hold him to that. But then again, that was before COVID happened, so.
Well, there's still time. There's still time.
Yeah, there is. And the thing with Land Rover as well, there's so many, I would just, you know, for your audience around the world, you know, since the production ended of the Defender, it's gone berserk. Land Rovers over here, you know, and Defenders are the cool car to have, the hipster car. In even not, thank God, not Freelanders, but Discovery Ones and Discovery Two.
Careful.
Going up. Actually, there's nothing wrong with the Freelander Two. That's got a Puma diesel engine in it. That's a good car.
There you go.
It's underrated, the Freelander Two.
Yes, Freelander Two. Now, the Freelander One, on the other hand.
I'm an original Freelander 1 owner, so, you know, that's why I'm a supporter of the original Freelander. Admittedly, it had lots of problems, but I think of it fondly.
Yeah, it did. And I mean, and they did have them in the Campbell Trophy in 98, but only that was it.
Well, yeah,
that's his claim to fame, isn't it?
And then the Campbell Trophy promptly
then
ended.
They learned their mistake. And
yeah. Oh, actually, I think they had them in the G4 as well, didn't they?
No, actually, you're right. It was not in the Campbell Trophy. It was in the G4. That was, I don't think there were any Freelanders in the Campbell Trophy.
Was it? No, 1998 was the Freelanders.
Yeah. Maybe they were support vehicles.
Mm. No, the Defender was a support vehicle. Without the Defender, they wouldn't have got through.
That's true, yes.
Something had to drag the Freelander through the jungle.
Yes, so their 75th anniversary event is, you're saying, it's going to take place then around the Snowy Hydro location. That'll be in 2023. Do you have a specific date yet for that?
It's in the past. It's run at Easter.
Okay.
And I've had quite a few people from your neck of the woods, as we'd say, who would actually contact me saying, can we come over? Can we do something? We've even got people saying, can we come on the Outback Heritage Drive? I'm thinking, well, you can't come in the country. But so I think, you know, hopefully in the next 6 months, when all this COVID is out of the way, we can start doing further plans. Even Tim Slesser, I've talked to him, and he wants to come, and we'll pay for his flight. I mean, it'd be great to have him here. I mean, he's in his 90s, I think, now, isn't he? So
late 80s.
In another year and a half, he'll be in his 90s. So
yeah. So if we could get him here, and that would be good.
Is the event a week? Is it a weekend? How long? And what kind of activities take place typically?
Yeah, the 70th was it was over a public holiday. So, yeah, 3 days. I think it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But running up to that, the clubs around Australia do their own thing. So there might be a club will go out and do a four-wheel drive day, you know, and run up to the Snowy Mountains. Some clubs have been doing how to repair your PTO, for example. So it was quite, the clubs were involved in that sense, but the actual, the event itself was, well, it was, we tried to do the world record for the most amount of Land Rovers in one spot. And I think we got 970 or something in the town. And then this key, I mean, obviously we went as a business as well, and which was good, but you don't get to see a lot when you're working and you're on your feet from 8 while 5. So this time we're going to do something a lot different. We'll just have key cars on display. We'll have Oxford. We'll have a Camel. In fact, there'll be hopefully another Camel Trophy. And a few other little bits and bobs. You know, having a nice informal kind of event for us. We're not going there to sell, you know, shock absorbers and those kind of things.
Right.
Boring parts.
Rooftop tents and,
you know, rooftop tents. And but people, and I think because Land Rovers are certainly defenders, you know, are very popular. There are a lot more younger people now who've come on board with the brand. And, you know, we talk to them and they go, oh, never heard of the 70th, but the 75th sounds amazing. So I think it'll be a good show, you know. Mm-hmm. A good show. And you can go for a day or you can go, you know, you can stay for a week. Right. It's obviously, it's a 2-day drive from Queensland. So we've got quite a long way to go, and obviously even further from Western Australia.
Is there a website people can take a look at for details?
There will be a website of At some point.
Okay, cool.
I'm not the organizer of it. In fact, a good friend of mine, another Englishman, he was organized the 70th, but now he wasn't working at the time, so he had lots of time to do that. And he's now working for a Land Rover company. So I don't know, you know, how things are progressing with the 75th. I know the local council want to do it because it brings in so much money to the town. And Land Rover do come on board with that when they have their... you probably have one of those things where you drive your cars up and they tilt and...
Teeter-totter? You're talking like a teeter-totter?
Yeah, kind of thing. I think it's like a display team. I mean, I hope it... I mean, I've talked to there's a councillor. He's just retired. He was the mayor of the town. And I talked to him not so long ago, and he really wants it to go ahead, but we've just got to... Whether I'm involved, whether my friend's going to get involved, I don't know. But
well, we'll certainly keep in touch with you. So as we get closer and things start, activities start to develop, we'll share with our listeners. Because I'm pretty sure that, you know, coming out of COVID, you just get that feeling that people are going to want to travel and go do things and get out and experience other parts of the world. And I think, you know, Land Rover people were probably going to do that. And there you may have a lot number of Americans coming down.
I think so. And, you know, our event was... It was so good. I mean, you know, for Nick Rogers, you know, director of Land Rover, to say, wow, this is amazing. You know, one of the best things he's ever done. So hopefully there'll still be that fire there to for the 75th. And yeah, you're right. People, I've been going back to England. I went back to Land Rover Legends at Bicester?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't go, obviously. I went in 2019. That was a fantastic event, a really good event. And it's nice because I go back and I see people. I meet Mike, I meet Tom. And, you know, that's the enthusiast. We go there and it's nice to see those people and see those old cars and, you know, and go around the Series 1 club and the Series 2 and the Army. And, yeah, that's what I've missed, especially with COVID, not being able to go to the UK. I think it's just watch this space. Keep an eye on the website. There's obviously the Facebook page, Oxford to Australia via USA and New Zealand, so people can jump onto there. There's lots of updates, lots of content from, you know, where Oxford's been in the past as well. And anything which will be happening goes on that Facebook page as well.
Justin, how did you get into Land Rovers? What was your...
How did I get the disease?
How did you get the disease? Exactly. Yes.
I must admit, when I lived in England, I would have never really probably had a Land Rover. I used to like Land Rovers, obviously. But for me, I think in England, especially defenders, were more for fire service or the police or the farmer before the Japanese came in and basically, you know, decimated all that. But when I arrived in Australia 14 years ago, I'd been here about a year, and I thought, right, now's a good time because I wanted to go touring. And, you know, I'm not going to buy... Actually, I'll tell a lie. I did actually... We bought a Hilux. Well, nice. I always wanted a dual cab, and I bought a double cab Hilux with a V6 in it, and it was the worst car I'd ever had.
It was
like a tram to drive around corners. It was fast. It was just not, it wasn't, it didn't suit. Anyway, so I bought myself a 300T.
It didn't have a soul?
No.
See?
It didn't, you're right. It didn't.
And it's kind of like a zombie because it has no soul and you can't kill it.
Well, they're indestructible, aren't they? that's for certain. Yeah. But yeah, I'm saying that, even my new, I drive a new Defender and it's the best thing ever. It's a phenomenal vehicle. It leaves the old Defender in the Stone Age, but it's not fair to compare the two. It's from a different time. But even that's got soul. I get in that car and... As a defender, an old defender owner, I see these, and it's got a couple of quirks, and I like it. It's not perfect, as in there's just not bad quirks, but there's just these little things which it does from time to time. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. That's a defender.
Such as? Do tell.
Oh, kind of. Sometimes it has a bit of noise from the door seal.
Okay.
Which, all right. And then sometimes when you put it into reverse, it doesn't. Sometimes you've got to click it again. There's little things like that. And maybe what else is there?
Does your right foot get wet when you drive in the rain?
No, it's pretty dry. All right,
then it's not a defender.
Like, you open it up and you see the door seals. There's like they've gone over the top of the door seals. Like they must have spent millions. We can't let this one leak any water.
Right, right.
But for me anyway. Yeah, going back to, so I bought a 300 TDI, which a lot of the purists say is the best defender ever to own because it's simple to fix, etc. And that was a lovely vehicle. And I did some outback traveling. That's really why I bought a Defender. I think we had a Golf as well at the time, which was fine. It's a good car. And then the Puma, which is obviously the last reincarnation of the Defender, came out.
It's the one we can't get yet.
Yeah, not 25 years old, is it?
Right.
And then, the Puma actually had been out a little while because it came out in 2007. But they reintroduced the double cab as a high-capacity pickup, which had always wanted the proper factory tub on the back. So I think I got the first one in the country, and I kept that car for 6 years, never had a problem with it. Just phenomenal. Just a really good car. And used that for the business as well because I started the business up about 8-9 years ago. And how I got into Land Rover business, actually, my original background, I used to do video production, and I used to actually do work. We used to do filming for the BBC back in the day, Match of the Day and horse racing. And it was only when I came to Australia with my wife at the time, and what do I do? And I did some video work here. And then Hannibal Safari equipment, which I think you used to have Hannibal equipment in the States, didn't you? There used to be a retail in...
I believe there was. I've heard the name, certainly.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were South African. And I had his products actually on my Defender at the time, and I really I loved the products, and I pushed it as much as I can, and he basically said, do you want to come and work for me? So that's how I kind of got into that four-wheel drive world, and did lots of shows, which was good. I could travel around Australia. And then, we split company. We fell out with each other. We're still good friends now. And then I just, decided to set a business up selling Land Rovers parts and equipment.
So you sell Land Rovers parts and equipment. And nice. There you go. New or used?
No, mostly new. We do mostly new. It's a big industry over here. There's a lot of competition, unfortunately, and it's selling parts is... No, it's hard. I'm going to be honest with you, it's quite hard work. But we know because we're passionate about Land Rovers, we're not just selling, roof racks or oil filters or nuts and bolts. It's more, for me, it's more of that history. And that's why we support it as much as we can. We're just about to launch. We're working with another company, not to say so much, but we're doing some very bespoke high-end defenders with LS engines, Cummins engines, auto gearbox, and even a battery electric nice. Defender. So some exciting projects in the next 6 months, which I'm really, really excited about, really excited about.
Have you taken your new Defender around Australia yet? Have you been able to?
No. In fact, I don't want to take it out to the Outback because it's a nice car. But the good news is, the dealer who Oxford was in the showroom are going to come on board and give us a new Defender to take out to the desert as a support vehicle, which is good, which will be good. Not that I wouldn't take, but I'm going to take the Camel. The Camel Trophy is actually going to go out of the showroom.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it has to be done. I'm going to have some wrap put on the front of it, a clear coat, so it doesn't get any stone chips, because it is a nut and bolt restoration, so it's worth a lot of money. So, I don't want to go and wreck. It's not like Bob Ives's Camel from the 89, which has still got all the battle scars. This thing's, showroom finish. So it's got to stay like that, but it'll be amazing just actually take it out there.
The irony is it's too nice to use in a Camel Trophy competition now.
It is too nice. In fact, I wish I could afford an old Camel, which I could go out and bush bash, as they say. And then I've got the one, the princess in the showroom.
So tell us more about this Camel Trophy that you own.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting story. So, when I was back at the Land Rover Legends in 2019, before COVID struck us, that's the first time I met Bob Ives at that show. And the club was there, the Camel Trophy Club was there, and I was talking to them about, I'm really keen. And I was going to look at a Camel Trophy 1998 down in Bath in the southwest of England. Cut a long story short, the club said, well, do you want to meet up for drinks that evening before you go and look at this car? I went, yeah, cool. So we went down into Bath and we went for pizza and a few beers, and I met Nick Cox and I forgot the other gentleman's name. But anyway, and we're talking about cars and I was showing them my cars, and they said, oh, don't rush into buying that Camel tomorrow because there's a gentleman in Scotland who has got one, but it's not for sale, but you never know. Okay, so we went to look at this one the next day. It was owned by a dentist. Lovely chap. He's got some medical condition, and his plans were to drive the Camel down to the Middle East, but because of his health, he couldn't do that. But he wanted quite a lot of money for the car, and it needed a lot of work doing to it. There was a lot of rust in the vehicle, which really puts me off. I'm kind of like, we sat down with him. We had some cup of tea and biscuits and things, and we agreed a price. And I said, let me think about it. I said, I've got something else to look at. Anyway, I rang this chap up in Scotland, an Englishman, and said, I hear you've got a Camel Trophy, but do you want to sell it or not? He said, no, I'm in no rush to sell it. He said, but if I've get the right offer. So we talked, and I thought, I don't want to talk him out of it. So I said, what do you want? And he said a price, and I went, yeah, fine. In fact, I would have given double that. I really would. And that was unseen. And 3 days later, I flew back to Australia and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I bought a Camel Trophy. And he sent me lots of photographs. And then I went back at the end of 2019 in September and October, and me and my father, we drove up to Scotland and we had a dad and son road trip back in the Camel, which was excellent. And then I went to Exmoor Trim, to see Exmoor Trim's production facilities. We're actually the agent for Exmoor Trim as well in Australia and New Zealand. So that's a good thing. So I went down there and we did a few things with them. And then I put into storage for a year and it finally arrived December last year.
What Camel Trophy did it serve in? And
so mine is a 96 build, but was a 97 Mongolia support vehicle.
For the UK? Oh, support vehicle. Okay.
Yeah. So those the competitors' cars for that event was the Discovery 300 TEI 5-door, and the 110s were support vehicles.
It still counts, by the way. I mean, even the support vehicles, they probably did worse things sometimes to keep up with the contestants. So.
Yeah, and if you're going to have a Camel Trophy, you've got to have a Defender.
Yeah.
Far better than a Disco.
Well, a friend of the show, Bill Burke, participated in the 91 Camel Trophy, and that was a Disco. So even though, but he's a Defender owner now.
If a Disco came up, I would certainly have like one in my collection. Yeah,
sure. You got to have one of each, right?
Well, yeah, that's true.
What else?
That was a full read. That the guy who did it, he is very meticulous about what he did, and he literally rebuilt that. He had a bit of a checkered history, actually. It got stolen, like Land Rovers do in the UK, some years back, and it went to Spain. And it was a lad and his dad who were stealing cars in the UK and sending them to their workshop in Spain and, you know, cloning them and do all this kind of stuff. And my car was actually painted green. It was stripped of all its bits, painted green. And it's a funny story because the dad caught his son in bed with his girlfriend and it came out in the press. It was a big thing. And that's then they found out and then they admitted about this stealing cars in the UK and sending them. And the guy who I bought the Camel off, he knew it was a Camel and he went down there and they went inside and they could see the original paint. So it went back to the UK and it had to be a nut and bolt restoration.
To be at that point.
Yeah. There was, he couldn't have obviously left it green, but so it was, that's why it was fully restored.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So the person you bought it off of did the restoration following its
correct.
It's been stolen and then it was stripped down.
Yes.
Okay. Was everything returned to the UK? Did they find all the parts?
Most of the, they found the roof rack in a scrap yard around the corner.
Oh, wow.
Kind of. So, but there were certain things, and I think it was things like on the front of the bumper on those, the winches on my event, the Super Winch, which was a factory option from Land Rover as well as one. And there's a metal plate, and these, which says Super Winch on it, and they're basically impossible to find. And he actually went to Super Winch and he said, "Have you got any?" He went, "Nah," he said, we don't sell them in old years. And they went, "Hold on, we've got an old display board we used to take to shows." And he brought, and he went, "That's the badge." So he was really nice. To get, and the stickers and the decals are in the right position. And, you know, everything is exactly, he went to town on the car. He made it proper.
Right. Had to do a proper restoration at that point. So.
Yeah. And it's amazing when you look at it. I mean, and it's a great thing. People love a camel. I mean, other than that, I think some people want to drive it. They probably look at it and go, "What does he do? Camel racing?" Because a lot of people won't have a clue what the Camel Trophy is. Right. Even Land Rover, in the younger generation who are coming into Land Rovers, wouldn't have a clue what the Camel Trophy is.
So you do drive it?
Yeah. I do drive it. Yeah.
That's good. What else is in your collection?
Oxford.
Yeah,
that's on loan.
Yeah, you don't get to keep that one forever, Pat.
No, I don't. I'd love to drive that back to England. I've got a Camel, we've got the new Defender, and I've also got a Series 3 Takar 1-ton fire engine, ex-Royal Navy.
Oh,
right on.
Tell us more.
This
is a Land Rover podcast. We like these details. You understand?
Well, this is another one. So, as a young lad, a lot of my family used to work in the military, and my cousin used to work for the RAF. And I always remember going to the airfield, big airfield in Finningley, Doncaster. It's now a commercial airport. One of the longest runways in the UK. You could actually land the space shuttle there. It's that big. And I always remember seeing these red Takar fire engines driving around. I'm like, that's a cool truck. That's so cool. And I'm never going to get one. And then obviously you grow up and whatever, and they went out of service and got sold off. And I was on a Facebook forum a few years back, and we were talking about fire trucks, and I said, "Oh, I'd love one of them." And this guy sent me a message and said, "I've got one for sale if you're interested." Oh. And I was like, "Too right, I am." He also had a Morris 1000 van, which is ex-bomb disposal. So he was into his old classic cars. His wife had passed away, and that was their passion, going to shows and things. So he kind of lost that love a little bit. And his cars were down in Devon, southwest England, and he used to have a mechanic who'd go in once a month and just start them up and things. And anyway, we agreed a deal, and I paid £6,000 for it, which I thought was a good price, because I'd always wanted a 1-ton Takar Land Rover. They're just so cool. And yeah, brought it here, and there's a few little things I had to do on it. And yeah, I must admit, it's up for sale at the minute, because I just don't use it. I know it's probably done 300 miles in 5 years. It's not.
But you still have it.
I have it, and I don't know, it's cool. I mean, it's got the searchlight, the blue lights, I've got all the proper outfits, the old from the 60s, you know, they used to wear for rescuing pilots.
Did you track down any of its history? So you said it was in the Royal Navy?
Yeah. So mine was Royal Naval Station called Rose in Cornwall, which I think is still a military, is for the Royal Navy. So yeah, I think it was demobbed in about 91, something like that. But there's not, there was about 70 made for the three UK branches. So the Army had them, the Navy had them, and the RAF had them. And I think there's maybe 10 or 15 left in the world. So it's a pretty rare truck, but it's not as sexy as a short wheelbase canvas back series car. You can take the wife out to coffee and the lunch at the weekend, you know, a big old fire engine on 900x16 tires. Right. Mm-hmm. Added standard. It's not. So that's why it's not.
Sounds sexy to me.
Well, it is, but I think it's a niche market. You know, it's not.
Yeah. Harold has a Series 3 RAF ambulance.
Okay. No, I do not. I have an Army ambulance.
Oh, my apologies. It's the Army ambulance.
Oh, the one with, has he got the bull bar on the front, the crash bar?
No, that'd be the RAF.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But Army didn't use those, but yeah, it's the Magic Marshal.
Yeah. They're nice. I like those.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. I'm enjoying my 130 more at the moment, but yeah. I've got an ex-Australian 130 I just bought last year.
Oh, okay.
It now has the 2.8 liter Cummins in it.
That's a good engine.
Which, yeah, turned up the fun factor a bit.
Very much so.
And are Defenders popular in the States now? Have they grown more so like they have in the rest of the world?
Yes.
Yeah, on steroids.
Yes.
Yeah?
It's a
cool car to have.
They've become ridiculously expensive here.
A couple of years ago, then Defenders could be imported, the 25-year rule. And we had a small number that are North American spec that were around. And though those ones now command double the price of what they were originally on the showroom.
Oh, keep going. It's more like quadruple, dude.
You can, the last of the line 2016 cars. I mean, my ex-partner, we got a 90 for her, cost us 49,000 Australian. That car, I could clear 80, 85 easy selling it. It's just, and there's no sign of the prices going down either. I don't know when this bubble will burst.
I don't know either. No, that's a good question.
That's hard to say.
It is hard to say. It's an excellent question.
But it's not the car for the average man. It's out of that affordable range as well, if that makes sense. I mean, same with Series 1s. I mean, you look at, that bubble in the UK is certainly burst, I think, you know, and Series 2s and Series 3s are in flavour. And they're more of a usable vehicle than a Series 1. Here, we're seeing figures of $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 for Series vehicles. No, Range Rovers as well, you know, old Range Rover classics.
In North America, the old Defender, is similar to what the new Defender is, which is a lifestyle vehicle. And that's even though they've not, you know, there's certainly no marketing of the old Defender that way. I think it's picked up that whole SUV overlanding, off-roading, even though we don't call it that here in North America, typically. It just seems to have brought that, you know, that lifestyle thing. You know, folks are taking it. You see commercials with old Defenders in commercials of people going, you know, going to a campsite in a remote part of Montana, you know. And so it's just all part of that, again, a lifestyle feel.
Yeah, they certainly use the old Defender, a lot of companies in advertising now, because it's the cool car to have.
Yes.
But the new Defender, I mean, I'd just give a good figure here is, the first 50 that my local dealer sold, only two people currently drove the old Defender.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Out of that 50.
Right.
And 70% of them had never even owned a Land Rover.
Yep.
Sounds about the same. I would think it's the same here.
And I think that was done deliberately to bring more people to the brand.
Land Rover weren't making money on it. You know, they sold lots, didn't they, in the last 2 years? Just like, you know, when they announced Concorde was going to stop. Concorde made more money in these last 2 years of use than it ever did. But I certainly think Land Rover with the new Defender have got it absolutely spot on. And I can say that, and I've got both old and new, and I sit in that new Defender, and I can see these cues to the past. And I don't think somebody who's never had an old Defender would see that. They just think it's a trendy car to have. I need one of those on my drive. You know that. You know, next year it could be a new BMW, couldn't it, or a new Merc.
And it's comfortable. It goes down the road. I can accelerate. I can merge onto the highway.
Yeah, and look, but the younger generation don't want to sit in an old Defender. You know, it's not an old Defender was quite specific. What, you know, and I know I talked to lots of women who are, I don't like that Defender, I don't like this, you know, but they'll drive an Evoque or they'll have a Freelander or, you know, whatever, a Range Rover.
The girl Rovers.
It's comfortable. It has to do with comfort.
I mean, I can actually have a conversation with somebody on the phone in my new Defender. I could never do that in the old one.
Or a Series 3, exactly, yes.
Or a Series 3. But the Grenadier is here. It's out in the desert being trialed. I think the Grenadier is going to, I like the Grenadier. I think it's going to fit in where Land Rover haven't gone with the Defender,
and we're going to either.
No, they're not. Hopefully that the Grenadier, you know, great for military. I mean, look at the British Army, 7,500 Wolves still in service. They're all past the use by date. Let's be honest. what a great vehicle they could do. The Grenadier would suit that perfectly.
We'll find out soon enough. You know, certainly a modernized old Defender.
Yeah.
And again, if it's comfortable and you can go down the highway and you can merge safely and keep up with traffic, these are important things for certainly a newer buyer trying to get into it. Those are important considerations.
Yeah. And Jim Radcliffe, who owns that company, I mean, he's a fanatical.
Yes.
You know, he owns JUE, you know, which we might even get here for the 75th. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, he's seen, obviously, you know, he tried to buy the rights for the old Defender, didn't he? And Land Rover went, no, you know, no way.
We're not going to do anything with it, but no, you can't have it.
No, and I did actually hear, I don't know whether you guys did that, there was talk about them rebuilding the old Defender in India.
I never would see that happen. No, because I mean, they were moving, the whole brand's moving upscale and had moving into, certainly here in North America, as a luxury brand, because they command high prices. You know, you can buy a new Defender for the same price you can buy an old Defender now.
Yeah, that's true. You can hear. And there's a big, I mean, I'm considering selling mine and making maybe 20 grand profit on mine.
Yeah.
Because people don't want to wait 18 months and there's the problems with the chip shortages and you can't have head-up display and you can't have this and you can't have that. So. Mm-hmm.
I know. Yep. I think you're probably a member of the New Defender group on Facebook, and you just, it's the crossover between the people on that group and all the other groups, say the Heritage groups, there's very little crossover of those folks. Mm. It's all those. And then, you know, the ones that are posting, you know, I just got my New Defender. It's very exciting. I've just ordered it. I'm waiting 18 months. What, you know, or what tire should I get? What, you know, what color would I like? And so there's a lot of those folks are just all new people. And that's where Land Rover's going. Yeah, I think they were closing the door on the past. I mean, you know, there was some discussion at one point of Land Rover being a larger car production capability, but you know, they had problems in the last couple of years with the end of Spaeth's run as CEO, and I think that quashed all those ideas. And then COVID hit and made it even worse to become a large car manufacturer.
As long as they support the heritage of the brand, I mean, and look at Land Rover Classic. I mean, I was surprised actually it took that long for Land Rover to, you know, to build that facility. I mean, certainly BMW and Ferrari and Maserati and Mercedes have been doing those restorations for many years. You could send your car back to, you know, wherever, Stuttgart or wherever it is. So Land Rover, I think, were quite late coming to that party. I don't know whether have you been to that facility in the UK?
Have not. They were going to build one here in North America in South Carolina, but COVID struck and that quashed that whole idea, because there was certainly a market there for it.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. We've seen the pictures and heard about it. Yeah, it's absolutely impressive. I agree with you. But it all goes back to money, which is the same reason why the Defender had not been updated. There was the money to keep the things going, and where are you going to put your money? You only have so much money, and they, you know, where are you going to put it? They had a whole, that you knew they had, we're going to have to build a whole new factory for this new vehicle, you know, and then not to mention development costs. And BMW and Mercedes are certainly way bigger car manufacturers than Land Rover ever has been.
I mean, and look at the old Defender. I mean, the works V8. I mean, phenomenal, but 150,000 pounds. Yeah. 300,000 Australian.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, it's $100,000 here, I think, for the V8, new Defender V8 coming, and a special edition, you know, then. So they're having that. Then they have the special bond editions now. They're making what, 300 around the world. Those are a little pricey too.
And we don't get those. In fact, remember they did the anniversary. I don't know whether you got the 50th anniversary for the Range Rover, and they had two colors. There was the banana gold, the gold one,
yes,
and the blue one. Mm-hmm. We haven't got any of those over here.
Oh, okay. I think, yeah, well, that was a limited number. Maybe that's just you guys unfortunately didn't get included. Sorry about that.
Yeah, they don't. They're a bit slack when it comes to limited editions in Australia. You don't get the nice ones.
Well, you know.
Even the Camel Trophy. Camel Classic or something? They did an old Defender, didn't they, this year?
Yes, right. I think you're right. It was the Camel Challenge. Was it Camel Challenge or something?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. They weren't proper camels, though. There
you go. Anything else in your inventory we need to know about? What, anything interesting behind you in your cabinet there that you're showing off your toy collection?
Awesome model Land Rovers. That's another addiction.
Yes. Looks like I see a camel trophy there. Looks like some defenders. There's a car trailer.
Number plates there.
Nice. You've got a camel trophy number plate, CT97.
This is my home office. Yes.
Nice. Very cool. Very cool.
So yeah, no, we do like to collect our merchandise and our little trinkets.
The nice thing about the small ones is they leak smaller quantities of oil on your floor.
Smaller drip trays.
If they're leaking oil, you may have a problem. Well, as you know, with the large sized Land Rovers, it's when they stop leaking that's when you have a problem.
Well, there's a word for that. The word is empty.
If it's not leaking oil, there's something wrong with it.
Right. Yes.
An Oxford certainly leaks a lot of oil.
And did you have to do any special work to Oxford yet? Anything, any special repairs or any special maintenance?
We fitted a new fuel gauge, because the fuel gauge, which I think is a good thing to do, especially when he starts going on his travels. You can't just be putting a wooden stick in the fuel tank every time.
Can't switch to the other tank because that part doesn't work.
We're actually going to probably get that tank fixed, I think. That's really? Probably a little job. Yeah, we'll get that tank fixed.
Well, that's an upgrade.
Yeah, we've done the electrics, which needed sorting out. Downside is really, really, really slow. And it's something to do with it. It needs a new needle for the carb. So that's... I mean, slow. I mean, I've got other series Land Rovers will just fly past him if he's going up a hill.
Yeah, it drove pretty slow here.
Yeah. And it's not a racing car. So if we can sort that out, that would be, that's really it, I think. The paint's coming off. I talked to Adam about the paint because I said, you know, one day there'll be no paint left on this car. It's literally falling off. And I think the more it's cleaned as well, and I was quite concerned with the pressure washing at the port because they use some pretty powerful machines. Yeah,
that stuff will take the paint right off a new car.
Yeah, but we've said we might try a very clear lacquer, so we're going to try a little bit on a bit we can't see, and we'll see if that actually works to keep the paint from continually falling off.
What about a clear wrap?
Oh, I don't know.
I just a thought I had in my head.
I think when you peel the wrap off, it's going to take the rest of the paint with it. That would be a one-way deal.
Leave the wrap on. If it's going to preserve the paint and the look.
Yeah, but if the wrap gets chewed up by stones and other stuff, you need to be able to remove it and replace it.
Yeah, true. I think a lacquer might be the way to go.
I think so too.
Because if not, it won't have any paint left in another 10 years' time. It'll be bare Oxford.
Yeah. Repainted again.
Well, maybe it has to go back into storage, flat packed on San Helena Island, and wait again for another 60 years for someone to find it.
It probably goes to a museum, I think. That's where it needs to go.
It needs to keep circling the globe, as I think Adam intended. And let people use it and let people see it. I think that's a great legacy for it.
Oh, we did. Just one last thing. I'll just remember. We did get a spot on the local news as well, which was good. So the Channel 9, not that I like Channel 9, but anyway, but they did a spot. They came down, filmed Oxford, which was good, and did a segment on prime time evening news. So it's good. And we'll have lots more events, planned in the next year, and there'll be loads of media exposure. So we will keep you posted.
And you're invited back anytime on the podcast, talk about Oxford and its adventures in Australia. We hope you come back and tell us more, because we like to keep tabs on Oxford as it's going.
I think the Outback will do something, especially hopefully six to seven months when we do his Outback.
Excellent.
You could even do a little bit of a feed from the Outback. It'd be quite good, wouldn't it?
We're holding you to that, Justin. We're going to hold you to that.
Yeah, I think that'd be cool.
That would be
actually
very cool.
live from the desert with Oxford.
All right, stay tuned. Live from the desert, Oxford in Australia. That'd be fantastic. Wonderful. Justin, thanks for coming on the program. We'll have links in the show notes to the things we discussed once you send me the YouTube link.
Yep.
Thank you very much for coming on. Appreciate your time.
Good to talk, guys. You take care.
And before we end the show, I want to give you a review of MAR 2021 and give you a preview of MAR 2022. MAR 2021 took place at the Wheatland Farm, and I
come to find out, it's the last time at Wheatland Farm. And we'll talk a moment about where it may go for 2022. More this year, it was weather was actually perfect. It was really nice. Weather-wise, I took my Defender down to the site, and Bill Burke was there, Jeff Aronson, Ralph Sarek. Those are names you may have heard about, folks that were there. And Bill Burke was putting on he did his off-road class.
Bill Burke was being Bill Burke.
Bill Burke was being Bill Burke, yes.
In every possible way.
I got to ride with Bill off-road, and that was a lot of fun. Enjoyed that.
Did he get stuck?
No.
I'm told he'll do that, but only on special request.
That's right. That's true. No, there was no getting stuck. Jeff Aronson was there, and he had a loaner new Defender 90 from Land Rover North America.
Of course he did, because he's Jeff Aronson.
And he did let me take it for a little tool around the grounds there, and it's really nice. But the thing I noticed, I don't know if it's just the 90, and I've been around a 110s before, I've been around some of the new Defenders, but for some reason the 190 felt huge, just really big. It has a lot of presence, and I don't know if it's the paintwork or if it's it's maybe the way it's stylized. It's not broken up on the side because it's just like one straight body panel, and there's the 110, there's some breaks in it, visually anyways, but the 90 just seemed big to me, like really big.
I wonder if that's just because it is so much bigger than the legacy 90. And so in that sense, it just seems big.
I don't know. I'm not really sure. It just has a lot of presence is what came to my mind when I was like, this is like really big. And I've certainly seen the new Defenders before and been around them, but this one in particular seemed large. And Ralph Sarek was also there. He has Sarek Auto Works, right? He had his modified new Defender 90 that is coil sprung, has done modifications, added some body armor to it, has the winch mounted externally on the front. And so he talked about that, and it was really cool to see. You've probably seen pictures probably on the internet. It was really cool to see in person. It's not air suspension, which is kind of a unique also.
Well, one less thing to go wrong, I guess. Yeah. I was down at the Overland Expo the following week, and he was there for that. And I didn't really get a close-up look at his truck, but I did see it. It was there.
Yeah, did a nice job with it, with the things he's done. And, certainly it's part of his business to sell, third-party extra equipment for that. So, it's for him, it's not just something he enjoys, but also part of the business. But he's done a nice job with it.
Well, if that's it's what a you're halo looking for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Showcases what they can do.
And then there was the RTV course. That was a lot of fun. Helped Jeff out with that. And as I said, got to drive the D90 that he had. And they ended up having a family photo, group photo. There was probably over 100 trucks there. They did that because this is supposed to be the last time at Wheatland Farm. And there were 6 new Defenders there as part of the photo. That was kind of cool. I think from the Center Steer account, I did repost that photo on Facebook. There's actually a video, from the drone that they had there. So you can check that out.
Did they have the blindfold competition?
Did not do the blindfold competition this year, no. They had the RTV course, off-roading, of course, is in the normal way that they do things. And we had the Saturday night dinner, and they had the auction.
I wonder if maybe they canceled the blindfold race due to the controversy of you winning it last time while listening to Bob.
Was probably the Scottish Bob.
Scottish. I mean, come on, that can't have happened.
You must have been able to see.
Oh, I must have. That's exactly it. I was the only one able to translate. What are you talking
There's
about?
There's no way I can understand what Bob's saying well enough to take instruction in real time from him. I need like a minute to process everything he says. And meanwhile, I'm looking at stuff rushing at. No way. I couldn't do that.
You should get extra points for that.
I think so. It increased the difficulty factor, especially over a walkie-talkie.
Hence, I think people thought you were cheating because there's no way that anybody could do that.
Well, I'll let you in on a secret, Harold. The walkie-talkie did the translation.
Oh, it was a Google talkie.
Okay. There we go, Google talkie. Well, maybe at the new MAR, next year's MAR, maybe they'll bring that back. So next year's MAR, MAR 2022, I'm calling it right now, back to Pearl's Pond, ? During while I was at MAR this year, they let folks know that this is the last year at Wheatland Farm. And so David Short did provide me with information on what's coming up for next year. So I'm going to read you these points and so you can prepare yourself for MARV next year. You know, Rove hosts MAR at Pearl's Pond from 1999 to 2007. And I think I was there for some, from 2002, 2003. I was there for about 5 years for those.
I was there for the 07.
Okay. The first MARVs were held at Penland Farm. I guess that's before Pearl's Pond. Pearl's Pond management has been passed down within the family, the Adamson family. They own the property. The new management has established the Little George Rod and Gun Club. It's a fishing and hunting club. And they have a website, which is the Little George rodandgunclub.com.
Oh, that adds an extra challenge to the MAR then, if you're negotiating the trails whilst being shot at.
Pearl's Pond is located in Buckingham County. It's about an hour and a half hours west of Richmond, Virginia, an hour east of Wintergreen. It's about 3 hours from New York City. Oh, he nicely added 6 hours from Pittsburgh. Thank you for that, David. Oh, he adds here too, 3,700 miles from Sully Hall. I guess I'm assuming that's straight line and not on a boat. The property has been expanded to include new land. Some of the old trails still exist. Some of the old trails have been moved or altered to allow for growth in the fields to attract birds and wildlife management. Not all of the old camping areas remain available. The new land will need new trails cut. New camping areas will need to be created. The property has a permanent pavilion with lights and power. The Rove, that's Rover Owners of Virginia Board, has expressed intent to move MAR to Pearl's Pond for 2022. And he made a point of bolding and underlining expressed intent.
Letter of intent day. We haven't signed anything yet.
The Rove Board will be having the first of what is expected to be several meetings at the Pearl's Pond site in November. The purpose of these site visits is to evaluate feasibility and to work out event hosting details with the land management in writing. The Rove Board will release final details, and as we get them, check rove.org for all the updates. And finally, all of Rove is very grateful and appreciative of Sam Moore and his survivors for allowing Rove to use Wheatland Farm for as long as they did from 2013 to 2021. That was MAR 2021 and MAR 2022. If you are in North America, especially if you're in the East Coast, it's an excellent event to come out to and attend. It always a good time is had.
And the inspiration for the Center Steer podcast.
Absolutely correct, sir. Thank you.
So you can go to the MAR and you can find yourself a campfire. You can sit down, you can swill a beer or a whiskey. You can tell some lies and you can experience what led to the podcast.
Which, interesting, Harold, you said is much like what I did with Bill Burke at MAR. We sat around, had a couple beers. We hope you enjoyed show number 103. Thanks to Morgan and thanks to Harold for coming on, guys. Thanks again, as always.
Yep.
Thank you.
Apparently, Dixon is still late as we record this, and I'm checking email. Nothing from Dixon. Apparently, he probably completely forgot.
The skyscraper has thrown a rod.
And thanks to Justin Burton for telling us about Oxford in Australia. Keep a watch on the podcast here. Hopefully, Justin will be back and keeping us up to date on Oxford in Australia. And also thanks to the One True Packs for his continued production support. In honor of the Land Rover's 75th birthday, you are invited to bring your Land Rover, specifically Series and Defenders, to the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix in 2023. This is your continuous reminder that it's coming up and you now have 20 months to prepare.
Mind you, if you really don't want to bring your Series or Defender and you have your heart set on bringing your Disco or your Range Rover, we will not turn you away for that simple oversight.
Visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's podcast. If you're listening to the podcast on our website, download a podcast app and subscribe so you have the podcast automatically delivered. We post a new podcast at the end of every month. You can connect with us on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, email, and voicemail. You can directly support the show at patreon.com/centersteer, just like Bob, Jeff, and Kristen did. Thank you very much to them. You can buy us a t-shirt, sticker, or buy us a tea or brown water. Click on store on the menu of our webpage.
Bob, we're talking to you, the brown water boy.
I also had some brown water with Bob at MAR. Yeah, it all comes together, doesn't it?
And did he tell you where said brown water came from before you ingested it?
It was sealed in a bottle, so I was not concerned.
Okay.
Thank you for listening. We'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. Click on voicemail on the website and let us know. Until next time, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover enthusiast, maybe around a campfire, maybe with a beer.
Or a whiskey. Lies are optional. And you may now resume your important things.
doing hydro on the fjords.